seasoned venture capitalists, they're like a bird's eye perspective on startups and businesses. They see so many things in so many different industries. Like, take their perspective, but at the earliest stages, the investor should be supporting you. Your job as founder is to see the direction you're going, take all these perspectives, don't let your head spin around and be confused and be like, that's a good idea. I heard that a couple times. Maybe I'll test that out, you know, but your investors who are in the trust tree with you should be building alongside you until something happens and your company looks like it's going to go bankrupt. And then hopefully before then, they'll step in and be like, we need to come up with a plan because you're not seeing that we're running into a wall.
Welcome to Austinpreneur, our show about the stories that made Austin, Texas, a global hub for startups. The show is produced by Capital Factory and hosted by me, Nick Spiller. As a reminder, by joining Capital Factory, you can plug into the ecosystem where the stories on the show were set. Learn more about us at capitalfactory.com.
We've got a very special guest. I'm going to do a quick intro. We're going to dive in, chat a little bit about investing and fund and a bunch of cool stuff. But y'all have a chance to ask questions too. And that's usually the best part. So please think of some good ones and we'll get to that in due time. But like I said, we have a very special guest today on Capital Factory's podcast. She's the founding partner of Halogen Ventures, LA-based VC firm funding the future of family.
Hey. Love it.
And they're doing that with a fresh $30 million fund that just closed. Before her VC career, she explored media and storytelling, including creating the Emmy-nominated series, The Valley Girl Show, giving her perspective that blends culture, entrepreneurship, and tech. Oh, thank you, Aaron. I didn't realize you hadn't set all this up yet.
It's already.
I'm just diving in, having fun. She's a fourth generation venture capitalist. I don't know how many fourth generation VCs there are, but it's a dynasty, the Draper family. We've had your third Draper on the stage. Love all of you. Not picking favorites. Well, you're my favorite today,
actually. Thank you.
Yeah, and she's investing in a trillion-dollar economy around the world of raising children, working parents, and thriving consumer ecosystems around families. Really excited to chat with Jesse Draper on the Capital Factory podcast. Welcome, Jesse.
Thank you. Thanks, everyone. Thanks for having me. I didn't need to think you lost that stage. It was great.
First time.
Do you feel good?
I feel great. I might leave here without my bat going out for once. Something about Tech Week always gets me going. But you're doing a triathlon, you mentioned?
Doing a triathlon on Saturday, guys. This is my first. Has anyone done a triathlon? It's very scary for me.
A few.
I just want to finish.
That's right.
You know, then it's winter. I just want to finish.
I'm just glad I did the 10 squats back there. But that was fun and it was a great way to warm up. But let me dive in. Let's ask. Your new fund's focused on the future of family.
Yeah.
What inspired that focus and how are you defining success maybe beyond just making millions and millions of dollars as a VC?
I'll zoom out a little, Nick, and thank you guys so much for having me. I love Capital Factory. I love doing deals with Capital Factory and that's all across the country. I'm Jesse Draper. I run Halogen Ventures. We invest in early stage, female founded consumer tech and B2B software. Right now, we're focused on future of family, how you support the family at work, at home, the physical health of the family, and the financial health of the family. Also, a new investor of ours is the state of Alabama. So, we also, I like to throw out there, have an Alabama fund. It's important because Alabama is ranked 50th for female founders, so we have a lot of work to do. So we're looking for great companies and co-investors in Alabama. We've already deployed some of it, and we're really pumped about that fund as well. So to zoom out, you kindly mentioned I'm a fourth-generation investor. I like to point out I'm the first female in line, and it didn't look the same, I think, to me that it did to the rest of my family because I was female, so I didn't think I could go into this. So like every other young girl, you know, I went to Hollywood, who wanted to, you know, I was like, oh, that's what I should do, go to Hollywood. I was in entertainment. I started one of the first TED Talk shows back in 2008, 2009. It was really silly. I would equate it to like a Borat-style think tech TV show. I know it was one of the first, though, because I had Elon Musk and Eric Schmidt on, and nobody cared. And it was those early days of, you know, let me take you back to days where we used terms like the blogosphere, and it was just blogs, and there were no pictures or video, and we were one of the first video content companies to partner with Forbes.com and Mashable and all of these other tech news sites who were looking for interesting tech-savvy kind of business news content. Took the show to TV. We were nominated for an Emmy. And after two seasons of that show, we ultimately built out a kind of TechCrunch-esque news site. And after two seasons of that show, I'd only interviewed incredible men in technology. And I felt like, okay, well, I didn't think I could go into tech because I was female, even though my family has been incredibly supportive and it was nothing, you know, against them. They say you can be, you can see. So I made an initiative to interview 50% women in tech, and they came. This was Sheryl Sandberg before she'd written Lean In, and Jessica Alba when she just started Mana's company. And had I fun back then, they all went public and it was fantastic. But through that, I started getting pitched what I call it still today, the Batwoman signal. I created this Batwoman signal. There were incredible women starting amazing tech companies, and they were looking for funding. And so we started getting just inundated with pitches for the show. And sometimes I'd say, you're too early for the show. Can I negotiate some sweat equity? And ultimately, I started writing some small angel checks. One of those did really well for me, and I sold on the secondary market for a 26x multiple. And then I had this nice little track record, had a few other wins, and used that to raise my first fund. My first fund, I pitched 500 potential investors how many entrepreneurs do you have out here? Hopefully lots. How many investors? A couple. And I pitched probably 500, and for you feel me, and I closed 85, raised $10.4 million for our first fund. We just closed our third, and we're just shy of $100 million AUM today. And so that's more than you ever wanted to know about my background, but I just wanted to zoom out.
Thank you.
You know, I don't come to Austin all the time, but I love Texas. We have some great companies, your Trust and Will. Do you guys know Trust and Will? I'm going to say it a lot because then your phone will blow up with Abby. Trust and Will. Trust and Will. Okay.
That's a good trick. I should do that more often. All right. And so with that backdrop, tell us about the new fund. What's new about it? We got the Alabama angle. We can talk about that.
The new fund, we're investing in this category future of families. And what we realized was over our last two funds, we had about a dozen portfolio companies that were focused around childcare specifically, and they were doubling in value year over year. They were really steady growth. They were doing really, really well, even through the pandemic. And we looked at that and said, you know, could childcare be our focus? And we actually went out with this thesis around childcare, and we got a lot of interesting pushback. A lot of people said, is childcare a big enough opportunity? I was like, well, it's like $548 billion, but I love a good challenge. And so we went and did a whole study. We called it our Future of Families study. We interviewed parents all across the United States. We asked what they were missing, what they were looking for, what they were willing to pay for. And we created this thesis around Future of Family, which is a $7.5 trillion opportunity. Mm. So that's why we're focused on that. We have great companies. We're, you know, when we started this, I said, one of our companies, Hop Skip Drive, which was one of these companies we did in the earlier funds, it's an Uber tech service for families in childcare. They're the only service that fingerprints their drivers and, you know, does a background check. So you can think about that next time you get into your next Uber and Lyft. But I'm sure they're all fantastic people. I'd have some great conversations with
many of them. Some of ours don't have drivers. Here. They don't even have drivers anymore.
And that's true. You may not. Yeah, you're right.
Don't need to worry about that.
That's very true. And so they started doing this deal with the LA City foster care system. And I actually said, okay, well, what does that mean?
This was $1 million deal for one of my businesses and seemed like a really massive opportunity. Do I even know what the foster care system is? Like, if I had to stand up right now, could you explain what the foster care system is?
Messed up. This is pretty much like, I just scared you all so much. You're like, don't call me. This is pretty much what happens in every room I ask in tech and in, you know, finance. It's really interesting. The foster care system is just totally broken, and it's kind of where our child care system begins. And I realized to start, we invest in companies that support child care all the way to our billion-dollar company, Babylist, which is the largest baby registry. And so the foster care system is incredibly broken. Children are property of the government. They end up in and out of the foster care system. And something I think about a lot is the fact that, so there's about 600,000, I would say to 1 million foster care kids in and out of foster care in the United States at any given time. They don't really know the number because it's always changing. Apparently, if we get the homeless off the street, 50% of the children will be out of foster care. And today, the incarcerated today, 70 to 80% of the incarcerated today went through our foster care system. So this is where our child care system begins, and we really need to solve it. So we have a company called Binti that is software that sells them to social services. Because kids were being matched with both adopted and foster families by hand, still are by hand, but they're now in 27 states. We started kind of building out from there. We now have Upwards, which has 66,000 in-home vetted child care locations targeting the 0 to 6-year-old. That's where children are typically neglected. At 5 or 6, hopefully you have access to a public elementary school, and that is changing. And so we started kind of building out from the idea that we need to solve foster care and then uplift the rest of the children in the area.
Yeah. I want to back up, and it sounds like you went after childcare initially, and that was $500 billion market, but your investors were like, not big enough. Yeah. Just kind of goes to put the venture game into perspective for you a little bit. And you touched on there's childcare, foster care. What are some of the other big buckets that took you from $500 billion to $7 trillion opportunity we're tackling?
Yeah, I mean, we look at healthcare and we look at, I like to joke, I was mentioning Preston Will over and over, our estate planning company, and I say we kind of go from baby all the way to death. I sit on the board of Preston Will. I love the team. They're incredible. It sounds very morbid, but we actually have a lot of fun talking about things like probate, and it's a great founding team. But we're looking at it from that angle, from, how can we support children, really targeting the 0 to 6-year-old in the United States right now, and then all the way to supporting families. I mean, everyone comes from a family. We love dog families as well. Nobody is left out. And we're thinking about senior care also.
Yeah, so elder care, yeah. Another big opportunity we've seen. Interesting. And then what stage, where do you like to see in companies from a fundamental standpoint before you get involved as an investor?
So we're seed investors. We like to get in as early as possible. So we'll, be kind of like first institutional check-in. And today we have over 75 portfolio companies. 5 are at over $1 billion in value today. 2 are about to go public. As long as everything goes well, you never know. We're really excited about those. So I think when we look at a company, is that what you're asking? Like when we see a company for the first time?
Yeah, for entrepreneurs, kind of thinking, what do they need to get to become interesting for an investor like you?
We're looking for incredible founders. I feel like at the earliest stages, you're looking sometimes at 3 to 5 people, with an idea and a deck, and you need to spend a ton of time with these people. So I think first and foremost, we spend a lot of time with the founders, which has been something interesting with this Alabama deal. We've just been in Alabama as much as possible because our network wasn't necessarily in Alabama. We needed to, I've now been to 5 cities in Alabama, spending time with all the founders that we wanted to invest in. Mobile is my favorite. Just so you know, it's so beautiful and obsessed with it. Also, I highly recommend the Alabama Safari Park. I've been on a real safari, and the Alabama Safari Park, I think, is better. It was so fun. It's on the way to Montgomery from Birmingham, just so you know. So I think spending time with those founders, really getting to know them, it's not a world where you should be investing through Zoom anymore, you know? An investment is trust, and I think it really goes both ways. You have to create trust to make an investment, and you need to trust someone to invest your capital in them. So I think about founder personality first and foremost. You need to be insanely optimistic. You can't even see the word no. You need to just think, well, this is how I'm going to get there. That doesn't work. This is how I'm going to get there. I'm going to get there, you know? We always say we want to make sure they're open to pivoting. And then the second thing is some kind of very unique proprietary product. We do invest in very saturated spaces. Like, we have some investigative businesses, and there are spaces where it's hard to pick the winner because there is so much going on there. And I always say you need to show me your three major differentiators. What is proprietary to you? Why are you the person to take this to the next level? The very most simple thing, we have a 100-item checklist, you know, but I'm just giving you three today.
Lift all 100, please.
Yeah, I'll go through all 100. And then the third is some kind of traction. And I never want early-stage companies to be intimidated by that. It doesn't have to be 100,000 users. It doesn't have to be $100,000 in revenue. Just show me there's a need for this. Show me some data that says there is a massive need for this.
And what are maybe some red flags or pitfalls that you see founders commonly hit when they're trying to raise money?
I think the most common thing I see is a founder who says, who wants to be in control of everything. They think they know everything about finance. They think they know everything about technology, and they're too scared to hire people who are smarter than them in these different categories. I think the best or different, you know, pieces of their business divisions. I think the most important thing as a founder is to be open. You want to create the best business you possibly can, and it shouldn't matter if they know more than you. I think I see that to so many founders' detriment. Like, I had a founder who pretended they knew everything about finance, and then, you know, we raised $10 million, and then 2 weeks later, it was gone. And, you know, we had, like, ever heard that story before? I'm sure, a couple of times. Now we're very, very, I mean, at the earliest stages, they don't always have a CFO, so we'll stick a fractional CFO in there immediately, you know, and we just want them to be open to learning, to hiring people smarter than them. I think that's one issue when they think, you know, I know everything about this. You can't possibly know more than me. I can't possibly hire these people because I know the most about every single piece of my business. How do you grow? You know, you can't run your tech team at $1 million, you know, valuation, and you can't run your finance team at $1 billion valuation. You really need to be much more open, good at working with people, good at building community, and also, the best founders are obsessed with the problem. You tell them something's wrong with their CAC, and they'll just obsess over it until they solve it. I think that's one red flag. The other thing, I kind of call it, like, it's a safe space. We're being thumped. I don't think I'll be canceled for this, but I call it, like, the egomaniac gene. And it's happened to me 3 times out of over 75 companies. I think that's okay. And they, like, wrote the book before they made the money. Like, the book called the, you know, my $1 million empire or whatever. And I'm like, where's my $1 million though? Like, where's my money? Or they go on the speaking tour before the product it has launched. And I think that is not great. Then they're more focused on being the star versus fixing the problem. So that's kind of a red flag to me as well.
Yeah, yeah. There's a... charlatans out there
putting on a,
I mean, you do need a certain amount of press, certainly in consumer products. You know,
you got to walk the line. You got to walk the line.
Yeah.
You know, and these people, some people make it work, some people don't. But I, you know, when I listen to your response, I think of like the, those open-ended questions in school. It's not just about getting the right answer. Often it's just as much or even more about your approach to getting the answer. And this is like a problem you got to sit there and wrestle with for hours and weeks and years of your life with an investor. And there's a lot of great companies out there. And, you know, if you're going to be an asshole about it, like, we're going to go move on to the next one, right? So
true.
It's a great, great.
Also, no assholes.
No assholes.
Work with assholes.
That's right.
Yeah, that's like a huge red flag for me.
That's
like,
right.
You're an asshole? No.
That's right. And I, you know, there's got to be really, really, really smart. And there might be a way to make it work on my end, but generally no asshole. Excellent. Excellent. Well, I'm going to ask maybe one more question and we'll open up to the audience. So y'all have a good bit of questions. So keep thinking. How do you really look at the upside of these ventures? You know, and I think it must be so hard, especially in this, you know, such an impactful space with the family and empowering women. But at the end of the day, there's only a particular type of business that can really produce venture scale returns, really grow at a rate with a certain amount of capital that can deliver returns to your investors, which is your, you know, a big part of your job. I mean, what are you looking for in that sense to really identify the big winners versus maybe something that'll be successful, but not necessarily, you know, I don't want to use any of the buzzwords, but, you know, something that really hits your return target for Halogen?
Yeah, I mean, we're looking to build million-dollar businesses, and I'm sure, you know, you guys see at the seed stage, too, sometimes companies will come to you and they'll say, building this business, you know, and then you do the math and you realize it's only a $50 million business. And I say, okay, cool, I don't see the billion-dollar business here, so go figure out what that is and come back to me, because it can't just be one product. I need a suite of products. So we're really looking for, you know, founders who are building that billion-dollar business. I think if you're asking specifically in future of family and childcare, I mean, we have many that are on their way there, and BabyList is a great example. You know, they're doing, I think, $700 million revenue profitably. They're the largest baby registry. They're at over $1 billion in value, and they're just
selling baby shit.
It's awesome. It's the coolest thing. And, you know, that proves there are opportunities in this space. I mean, that's only one example. And then, you know, we think about, you know, how do you support, like, and then in childcare, I mean, upwards, you have 66,000 in-home vetted childcare locations across the country. They're the tech that powers it. They offer corporate benefit programs. They're the most affordable option for childcare between the 0 and 6 age, because childcare is unaffordable for 99% of society today. As I'm sure many of you are aware. And so they're tackling it from a tech perspective. They also have, you know, an 8-figure deal with the government to subsidize costs for those living below the poverty line and can't afford childcare for their children. And so I see that 66,000 in-home headed locations, that's the largest network of childcare locations in the country. And they're just off to the races. So there's a lot of opportunity here, and it's really tech enabled. It's, you know, we have Binti, which is, I mean, not Binti, Mirza. Too many portfolio companies. Do you feel that way?
There's a Trust and Will, right?
Trust and Will.
Okay.
But Mirza is a childcare benefits technology software for hourly workers in Costco or Target who can't afford childcare and need technology to access the government benefits, and corporations are so excited about what they're building. So there's a lot of different, I mean, avenues. You have benefits all the way to a baby registry.
Yeah, and see, this might just
healthcare,
be one
tech.
Right. One observation is just that all those companies are set up to serve the market across the country. Mm-hmm. And, you know, BabyList, people can go there, sounds like, list their name, but also buy products. I'm a dad, and you buy a lot of products. It's amazing, actually. Like the things you don't even know, if you don't have kids, the things that exist that you'll need that you don't even know exist, it blows your mind. But also, yeah, like taking the childcare where you're able to
acquire the supply in a unique way. And it sounds like they partner with people that are regional or local, but they're able to put a nationwide brand on it. So then you go market, you can get people from all over the country and really tap into that. The
well, and Babylist will go international.
It's the international, yep. Excellent. Who has a question for
It's a big Jesse? Upside. That's the question. Big upside for childcare.
So what's the most successful company you've ever invested in, and what did you notice in that company or its founders that differentiated it?
It's so hard to pick one. I mean, I just talked about Babylist, so I'll give you a different one. I think that, and like successful in, yeah, I'm invested in Metropolis, which is a parking technology company. I had worked with their founder and been an advisor on their first parking business, so I knew this was a proven founder in the parking. They're like paperless parking, so if you drive in, you know, they take a picture of you and know everything about you. Actually, my business partner texted the founder and said, hey, this wasn't me. I just got like a $90 ticket from this lot, and he just texted her a picture of herself in the lot and was like, no, this is you, right? And she said, okay. So it's really great technology. They were just thinking, how can we own parking and beyond? How can we make parking so easy? And a couple of years ago, they raised $2 billion to acquire SP Plus, which is one of the largest publicly traded parking businesses in the country. And they're building even more products for parking. Now they own lots. They do all the tech in the parking lots. They provide services for other parking lots. And they just, I think the best founders look from the top down. You know, they think, we're going to own everything. We're going to own this whole, that's how you build a $1 billion company. It's not just the parking, you know, the parking tech that is paperless. It's like, how do we own the whole circle, you know? And so I think they're some of the best founders we've ever worked with. They also, I find the best founders are very communicative and get back to you no matter how big or small an investor you are in seconds. And it's such a simple behavior, but we actually now have data within our portfolio that the founders who aren't communicating with us are not doing particularly well, and they should be because we can support them or help them. So they're also very communicative, which I appreciate.
Excellent. Good question. Boss.
Hi. Good afternoon. So my question is about the go-to-market strategy. It sounds like you have a lot of experience with multi-prong platforms that are, you know, working to attract several different types of users to create, you know, the flywheel. And, you know, the question, what do you go after first, the chicken or the egg and all that? And so, you know, just with the advancement of AI and how fast different, you know, lead gen and go-to-market strategies are coming at us. As we talk about it every day, the phone picks up on it. We just get bombarded with different
trust and will.
Trust and will.
Yeah, so we're launching a similar business and, you know, trying to go from 0 to 100,000 users over the next 6 to 9 months. And so we're gonna, invest our capital to do it. And so, you know, there's just this fear of, you know, the ROI and wasting.
What kind of product is it?
So it's a multi-vendor marketplace. It's called homeshow.ai. It's unifying all the verticals of the home, products, services, real estate itself, autos, events. And so it's really exciting. We've spent 2 years building it. We've invested over $1 million of our own cash to do it. So we're launching at TechCrunch next week at Disrupt. And so we're...
So it sounds like you're launching off in Tech Week right now.
And Friday night here, by the way, at Tech Crawl. So,
heard it here first.
So anyway, yeah, we're just, just racking our brain, you know.
What is the question?
What's the best go-to-market strategy? Where should we apply our capital?
I mean, I don't know what kind of customer you're trying to, is it the general consumer, your marketplace? Can I just go on and buy?
So it's homeowners and heads of household, primarily as the demand users and product and services.
Oh, and it's searching for anything in the house to purchase?
On the product platform, but then there's a service platform for service providers that service anything in or around the home, everything.
I feel like I need to take a pitch from you and hear what's going on. But overall, I would say
Google Ads are bankrupting companies. We need to figure out something there. With AI, I mean, make sure you're like the first search in ChatGPT, Perplexity, all of those. We're seeing some success there. I think with... you are AI, so do you need to get people to go to your marketplace? We should talk about this later. This feels like a more complex, but go-to-market strategy is critical. Listen to your customers. I think your first 1,000 are the most important. Hear exactly how they found you. Get on the phone with them. Never stop getting on the phone with them, you know? And if you are targeting, women and heads of household as your customer, look for people who share a customer and do our companies in our portfolio have such success doing email swaps, hosting events, doing giveaways, working together with similar customers. I think that's a great way to kind of launch and get out there with that specific customer. But I need to fully understand what you're doing. I need to see it, and visual.
And it's probably not like she said, paid ads, whether it be Google, Instagram, those platforms are so competitive
now. I want to talk to Google about this. I had them come speak to our portfolio. Aren't you guys so annoyed with how expensive Google ads and Meta ads are? And it's just like, there is no ceiling. And I understand they need to make money. They're making plenty of it. Stop bankrupting all these companies, right?
Yes. Yes.
I'm done with my rant.
We're happy about the driverless cars, but let's lighten up on the ad spend here.
So you mentioned you're involved a bit in the childcare space, and especially within childcare, there's tension between scaling profitability and staying mission oriented. So how do you support and advise your portfolio company founders with maintaining that mission while still scaling?
This is my life's work is investing in women, and I literally wrote an article that's called Investing in Women Isn't a Fucking Charity, because I really walk the line. It's so hard. Sticking. So unnecessary. But feel free to read it later. But I really walk the line of I have to try so care. It's so hard not to be seen as charity when you're focused on women, which doesn't make any sense to me, because we're building billion-dollar businesses. So every investment we're making is impactful. I mean, my goal is to create at least $1 billion of value for each female founder within our portfolio. And by the way, we love men. I have 3 little boys. I was raised by incredible men. This is not a man-hating club. We need everybody. And we have 5 male CEOs, so they're the minority in our portfolio, but we love men. We need everyone. But I want to create $1 billion of value for every female founder in our portfolio. And the data says that inevitably goes back into a more, equity focused ecosystem. And so it creates wealth for women. And it is really important to do that. I also try to prioritize teaching women how to invest, making sure all the women in this room are putting their money to work. And anyone who has a daughter, a sister, a mother, who says they don't understand finance, bring them in the room with you. Talk to them about their money. Make sure they're taking risk with their capital too. I think women are really good at taking calculated risk, and they'll actually help you invest better. But what women need from all the incredible men in this room is the gut check and the take the gamble. You need both sexes here. And I think that's really critical and something I advocate around. But I try to focus on for profit is how I would answer that question. Everything we do is making an impact.
The point I like to make is the for-profit companies are able to attract capital, follow-on capital at a far greater rate than the nonprofit companies, right? You're kind of limited by this tax deduction thing. It's just, And so it's not bad to make money, you know, and it actually allows you to grow and make a larger impact because you can attract more investment and grow. Like Uber is a great example. And I think there's a lot of critiques of Uber, and I'm not talking about everything, but I think they did a good job addressing the problem of drunk driving. And, you know, for a long, long time, drunk driving is a really bad thing. A lot of charities tried to solve it, a lot, you know, there was a lot of efforts, and but it wasn't until a technological solution that was funded by a bunch of capitalists all over the world that made a bunch of money that now you really like got to go out of your way to drink and drive in a city, and like it's a great solution. So yeah, I think there's a bit of a perception issue around that. Good question. We have another one.
Yep. Hello. So me and my wife, we're two working parents. I have one small child in daycare. I have another one on the way. And so many other parents I know who are like me, this is one of your biggest expenses. You're shelling out thousands a month for childcare. And I'm wondering if you're investing in any companies that are kind of innovating in this space to kind of maybe help relieve the burden that so many families know, like mine with two working parents, are just shelling out money every month for childcare.
We have a newer company in our portfolio that I'm really excited about called Kina Rewards, and it's essentially going to be a credit card for all childcare related services, tuition, et cetera. I'd equate it to, you know, healthcare insurance. And so that's one that I would say is innovating in that space. But check out our portfolio. We have all the services you need, I assure you.
Hi, I'm Josh. I have a question for you. So when it comes to pre-seed companies, companies that are very early stage, perhaps they don't have a product on the market, so they don't have much validation, what do you look for in terms of them standing out or deciding if they're worth your investment?
We aren't investing in pre-seed as often unless you have, do you have a product already? Or are you
not on the market yet, but in active development.
I want to know how you're making your first dollar. I think gone are the days of like, I don't have a product yet and I'm not sure how we're going to make money. That doesn't make any sense to me or any investor in general. So I don't know why there was a world where that happened. But I think, you know, we want to know how you're making your first dollar, that you have the business model worked out. I would go back to saying, show me there's some traction here. Show me there's data that there's a massive need for what you are building.
Great, thank you.
Is it a software product?
Yes.
Yeah. So it's like in today's world, it's a really, really hard pitch to say, I got to fund you to build your first version of your software product. And it's, you know, I would open a challenge, but it's almost 99% chance it's going to take you less time to just go figure out how to use these AI tools.
Yeah,
then go try to raise money, right? You're going to spend more time trying to track down investors and everything, and when you could just go build it. And that also is going to make you look more impressive to investors because you can figure out how to build things. So it's a big piece of advice. All right, where are we at?
Hi there. So me and my team just recently are exiting an accelerator program with $100,000 of funding.
Congratulations.
Thank you so much. We're hoping, thank you so much. No need, but thank you so much. But yeah, we're really excited about it. But we're also kind of scared, you know, because we're a pretty small team. We've run things pretty lean, relied on earning our first dollar through various means besides our product and service. And so what is some advice that you would have for someone exiting that program and then entering into, you know, higher rounds of funding, seeking new investment in the next couple of weeks?
What are you scared of, just getting out in the world? Or
yeah, I think it's the whole team's kind of nervous. We have an instant demo for a software that helps automate different sales activities, and it's actually working really well. It can be done really fast on our website, but we're also just kind of scared that, you know, if it breaks, the negative impression from that might, you know, harsh some vibes with certain potential customers or investors. And so we just want to make sure it's the best product that it can be. We have it where we think we're pretty happy with it, but we're also still just wanting to maybe get some general advice, especially to women founders and investors, about how to make our product stand out and also just make sure that it delivers where it's really crucially needed to at this given point in time.
I mean, can you have some focus groups with some of your first customers and just really learn from them and, you know, hear exactly what they're saying, what they're liking, what they're disliking, if it's about getting out there into the world? if you're scared to go raise again, I mean, you're going to be raising. You got to get over it because you're going to be raising for a long time. Unless you can figure out how to be super profitable right away and never have to raise again, which is, it's truly the dream, right? But I would think about it that way. I just get to know those first customers. I think that's what you're struggling with, maybe, like just the first step after the accelerator. Like you felt like the accelerator was your nice home and you're all cozy in the accelerator. And then you got this $100,000 and you're like, wait, shoot, we have to leave the cozy home. Is that what you're feeling? Okay, you got to get out there. You got to rip off that Band-Aid.
Face your fears.
You got to go make it feel uncomfortable every single day. You know, get past the nose, go pitch, go fundraise. Like, you have to breathe fire. You have to be able to walk through walls. You can't be scared of anything as a founder.
Hell yeah.
Okay.
Yes. Find some warm-up customers. Maybe some customers that you're not as worried about if things go wrong, and then approach them first.
Right here, and then I think we got another one over here too.
Hi, I love your jacket, super cute, Chanel. Okay, quick question.
Well, it looks much cheaper than Chanel.
Do you have advice for someone coming into the SaaS space that is from a more clinical medical background, like myself, looking to connect with investors and VCs outside of different incubators, pitch opportunities? Is there a network, a platform, a dashboard, some way to try to connect?
With investors?
Yes.
And are you saying like a female-focused thing, or are you saying like a just generally, you're at Cap Factory, so that's awesome.
Yeah.
You're in the right place, okay. For sure. I think go to every networking event you can. And figure out what, I mean, it depends. If you're looking for customers, go to that type of networking event. I think the more accelerators you can do and be around, the better, because mm-hmm. that's just the center of the ecosystem.
Right.
Are you trying to raise money? Or are you trying to?
Trying to raise money. So in the seed round currently, and so we've done like the wireframing, we're doing that. We're looking for seed fund. We're looking for specific types of consultants to accelerate the product implementation. And so just looking for advice coming from that space, you know, that we're not necessarily from the tech world. Yeah. And just, it's been a new environment. So it's been cool, but different.
Yeah, just meet as many people as you can, you know, show as many people your product as you can and say, hey, do you know anyone in this space? Start with your network, grow it. LinkedIn is a great tool. I mean, I scrape LinkedIn. I do really shady things too, where like I'll speak to a room of people that are investors and I'll screenshot the Zooms. I shouldn't tell people this. I screenshot the Zooms and then we go through all the names. Like, you have to be super scrappy and just meet as many people as you can, email them. I mean, you can get a hold of anyone these days. We have so many social media tools. I've taken pitches through everywhere from X to Instagram, you know, to LinkedIn. And so just, you know, figure out who you need to get a hold of and just go get a hold of them. They're speaking at a conference, get a ticket to that conference, like, or just show up in the lobby and stalk them. Maybe rethink that. That probably isn't the best way to go, but that's the kind of stuff that you need to do.
Right. Okay.
Be a stalker.
Hey, I'm here.
I need to filter myself.
It's only stalking if they don't like what you're doing.
So. Yeah, totally. If they like it, it's going to be great. If they don't, just walk away. Yeah.
The other point I would make to you is it sounds like you're from the healthcare world. Physicians, doctors make great angel investors often. They're also like might not be getting hit up as much as professional VCs. So you're a little more unique. So starting there can be helpful. And then also if you come to me and say, oh, these, you know, I've worked with these doctors, I started this, they funded it. That's a great signal from your industry that can get better attention from more generalist investors or professional investors. Did you have one?
That's probably.
I don't want to miss you. Yeah. All right. Raise your hand again. I want to make sure we get it right there. And
question.
Yes. Yes. Correct. Perfect.
So my question is, when you advise companies or you invest in companies that work on complex social situations that aren't the norm in thinking, how do you balance that when maybe the founder is very familiar with the space and the mentality, but you're not as an investor?
As an investor. So you're saying you know more than I do about this topic because it's your company, right? And you're saying, how do you balance
more about the social aspect? So I guess one thing that I'm concerned about by looking at investors is that they don't understand the complex social problem being solved, and they try and take it in the direction they think is right. I'm not saying that no advising, but yeah, not understanding.
I think I see what you're saying. You're saying, you know, I look at it like I am the investor, you're the founder, okay? Ultimately, you run the company. You see the vision that I don't see. I'm just there to support your vision. I'm there to build alongside you. You tell me what you need. You need a great CMO, I'll find you a great CMO. You need me to dig in to find comps in the market, I'll find comps in the market. You know, I'll do whatever you need me to do until I start seeing you, you know, the business is going poorly and I identify that there's a problem within the business. Then it kind of sucks to be on the board in that situation. Many a times I've been on the board in that situation, and it's like, it's all fun and games and you're friendly until you have to turn the mirror around on the founder and say, look, this isn't going so well and I don't agree with the direction you're taking the company in. And I think that I would give most seasoned venture capitalists the benefit of the doubt in that they're like a bird's eye perspective on startups and businesses across internationally. Like, they see so many things in so many different industries. And so it's a pattern recognition thing where it's like, if they're pointing out a problem, you know, listen to it. And I think until you have to and the board is trying to put you in a direction you don't want to go, like, take their perspective. But at the earliest stages, the investor should be supporting you. Whichever way you're going, the investor should be supporting you. Your job as founder is to see the direction you're going, take all these perspectives. Don't let your head spin around and be confused and be like, that's a good idea. I heard that a couple times. Maybe I'll test that out. But you can't do everything and you can't please everyone, you know, but your investors who are in the trust tree with you should be building alongside you until something happens and your company looks like it's going to go bankrupt. And then hopefully before then, they'll step in and be like, we need to come up with a plan because you're not seeing that we're running into a wall.
They say go where the money is, but it sounds like you also need to be picky and choosy on who you choose to have.
Oh my gosh, yeah, I've had a bad investor I had to buy out too. You gotta be really careful and make sure your investors bring value. It's hard to get an investor, you know, this is a 10-year marathon. It's like a marriage you can't get out of, you know? You can't. So you need to really like these people, build with them, and it's gonna be hard, up and down and all around.
Right. Well, Jesse, thank you so much for coming into Austin to be here with us today. And how about we all stand up and give a warm ovation to Jesse. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you so much. Jesse@HalogenVC.com. That's my real address.
Jesse@HalogenVC.com. Thank you all for coming. Enjoy your tech week.
Thank you. Thank you, guys.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Austinpreneur. Don't forget to check out CapitalFactory.com to learn more about us and join our community. If you have thoughts about the show or ideas on how we can work together, reach out to me directly via email, NickSpiller@CapitalFactory.com. Shout out to the Capital Factory Dream Team for making this podcast possible, and special thanks to Aaron Handworker, who masterfully recorded and edited the show. Come back next week for a whole new episode. Mm-hmm.